On March 11th and 12th, hundreds of people converged in Oakland and San Francisco for a two-day conference called the ROAR, or Revolutionary Organizing Against Racism Conference. The festival brought together Black liberation, indigenous, anarchist, and anti-fascist groups to discuss and look back not only on past struggles for liberation, but to think and strategize about the path ahead. It's Going Down was lucky enough to be able to record some of the talks that took place. This is one of them. What follows is a presentation from the Black Women's Defense League out of Dallas, Texas, and Chicago. Thanks for listening.
Situation. You're going to get the opportunity to watch a little documentary that was filmed a little while ago about us. But basically, having dealt with domestic violence and also being a member of a militant organization and being very, very much involved and indebted to the struggle and to liberation, I really found myself at a really kind of awkward crossroads. And it was like, go here and like separate or try to make something bigger and better and more formidable against these issues, because it's not something that's uncommon. In fact, if you look out there on the books, I don't know who I'm like promoting right now, but this book is incredible. And it's The Revolution Starts at Home, Confronting Intimate Violence Within Activist Communities. You have no clue like how excited I was to like find this book, because I was just like, other people are like dealing with these things. It's like a thing, you know? And it was really helpful, and it's been really cathartic to read it and check it out. But without further ado, I want to also let you talk to
Johnson. I am currently based out of Chicago right now, for the time being,
But I started an organization called Birthright Africa with another woman. And what we do is we take African American youths and young adults on a free trip to Africa. So we're actually going to be taking our first round of scholars in August, 10 people. And hopefully we can grow from there. But yeah, we can do the video now.
Thank you. All right, so now that you know a little bit more about Black Women's Defense League, we want to know what you know about Black women. Cool? Yeah? All right. So we're gonna play a little bit of a game. Everybody likes games, right? Especially games with prizes, right? I don't even believe y'all. Like, it's like, they're like, yeah, I guess, maybe. So, there's something that has happened, and that's one of the things that we're gonna be talking about today is dismantling misogyny and patriarchy and paternalism in Black liberation movements, and really kind of talking about the history of that. There's a lot of history, very much similar to the movie Hidden Figures. Have you all seen that? Yeah? Where the stories of Black women have been erased or diminished, and sometimes just straight up mistold or untold. And so we just wanna try to test, see who's out there, see who knows what. And let's see, we're gonna start off, we just starting with your Black, with?
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to make a couple of statements and then I want you to guess who I am. My art appeared in the Black Panther Party newsletter. My style was the most widely influential among the other artists and illustrators of the party. Keep going. Somebody said something else. I didn't.
Eric Huggins.
Okay.
You're all wrong. Anybody else before?
Emery Douglas receives the most attention as the art director of the Black Panther newsletter, as well as the party's Minister of Culture. But Gail Dixon, Asali's bold drawing stood out in the newsletter alongside the other male illustrators. She said of her work, if you couldn't read, you'd still get it through the images, which often depicted older Black women, children, and women with guns, as well as groceries, with copy and details that highlight the mission and commitment of the Black Panther Party to the community, focusing on police brutality, hunger, and housing. Many of her male colleagues adopted her style, but the womanism inherent to Gail's work was missing.
So I was the first Black medical social worker in my city of birth. I'm gonna mess up this name, but it's Barenkutwa Hospital. I was the leader in the African National Congress and fought especially hard 25 years plus against apartheid in South Africa. I became an international symbol of resistance and rallying point for the poor Black township residents who demanded their freedom. I was arrested under the Terrorism Act from 1969 to 1970 for 17 months, was put in solitary confinement in the Pretoria Central Prison, and am a member of Parliament, African National Congress, and the National Assembly of Africa. Who is that? Okay, all right. Hey, that's right, it is Winnie Mandela. You can go to the next slide. So I could like throw it. Okay. No, it's over there. Okay, cool. So Winnie Mandela and her legacy is often wrongly kind of scandalized and demonized due to her having been a woman in a role that was subscribed to men more often than not at that time. Nelson Mandela
pretty much spent the entire apartheid in prison. And after he got out, he was kind of given all the accolades for the struggle that ensued during it, as well as the presidency. He distanced himself from Winnie very shortly after he got out of prison because politically they were like, you know, she's done all of these other different things. You shouldn't be next to her. And although she remained by his side, he left her. The unpopular decisions Winnie made were no different than those that many men would have made with little criticism in those same situations. She was charged with or accused of necklacing people, you know, who were in opposition to the party. Necklacing, if you're not familiar with that term, is pretty much putting a tire around somebody and burning them, right? As gruesome as that sounds, and perhaps is, it was once again not something that was an uncommon or unheard of thing, and had she been a male who had done something similar, she would have been a, you know, a violent freedom fighter who was willing to do whatever was necessary to keep party secrets and things of that nature. She was scorned for infidelity, but a lot of people don't know that when Nelson Mandela met Winnie, she was 16 years old, and he was married with 3 children. They met at a bus stop, and he left his wife and his 3 children very shortly after meeting Winnie Mandela. But oftentimes you'll hear about, you know, her infidelity during the time while he was in prison for several decades. And this is just kind of just another inference of how it is that the stories of Black women are sometimes told in under a different light or more highly scrutinized than others might be.
Right. I started the Stonewall Riots in 1969, and I dedicated.
Are you not people?
Yes, I don't know. Do you want a button?
Okay.
Yes. So Marsha P. Johnson. Marsha P. Johnson started the Stonewall Riots on June 28th in 1969, the police busted into the Stonewall Inn and planned to do what they had done many times before, which is harass and beat the patrons of the bar. And Marsha P. Johnson was not having it that day. And she threw a shot glass that started the 3 days of rioting, which led to basically the creation of LGBT rights movement. And she also co-founded, shortly after the 3-day riot, STAR, which stands for Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries. She was also an activist and organizer in ACT UP, as well as the Gay Liberation Front, which ensured that young drag queens, trans women, and other street kids living on Christopher were fed, clothed, and housed. Miss Major Griffin Gracie was also another Black trans woman who was involved in the Stonewall Riots, and she has recently blasted the 2015 film Stonewall for completely erasing her and having Marsha's direct action attributed to a fictional cis white man who they just made up so that a white person could save the day. And although the actions of Marsha were the catalyst for LGBT rights movement, the group that was afforded the greatest benefit is cis white gay men, and Black and Latino trans women are still on the front lines fighting to end police brutality and violence against them. And they are also the least protected and most vulnerable to violence to this day.
Okay, so I feel like, close your eyes real fast. Okay, y'all didn't see that, just pretend you didn't see it. Okay, so I recognize discrimination on public transportation and refuse to give my seat up on a train. I was a fierce anti-lynching advocate through organizing and journalism. Don't say the name yet.
Who said it?
I was fired from my job as a professor because I openly criticized racism in the school system. I am the editor, was the editor and owner of Memphis Free Speech and Highlight, as well as the Chicago Conservator, the city's first African American newspaper. Who am I?
I don't do well.
Who was it? I heard it in this area. Okay, cool. All right, that's right. It is Ida B. Wells, if you'll switch that over. So, Ida B. Wells, many people don't know that 70 years before Rosa Parks sat down and was really pretty much selected because she was a little bit more pleasing to what that, the people who kind of constructed that movement around the bus boycotts and things like that. She was really chosen more so or less because there were other women who sat down prior to that, one of whom was pregnant, and so they were like, well, we can't use her, she's young, she's pregnant. But Ida B. Wells did this 70 years prior to that. Now, she was excluded, as all women were, from prestigious organizations like the American Negro Academy. This might explain why Wells, though recognized more than many, is not often elevated to the ranks of renown along the sides of people like W.E.B. Du Bois, who was a key member of the ANA, in the historical memory of Black activism. In fact, W.E.B. Du Bois removed her name from the list of original NAACP founders. The oversights could be explained in part by her reputation as a difficult woman. Wells was certainly that, even when taking into account the double standard that applied to assertive, independent women. On the other hand, history books are filled with the names of combative and highly individualistic males. I concluded that Wells was a victim of the same progressive movements that she was a part of. Predominantly white reform organizations could never subscribe to her views about race, and those with race-based agendas, such as the NAACP and the NACW, and to a lesser extent, the Urban League, could not accommodate her views regarding leadership, class, and sex.
This one's really hard. After the 2013 acquittal in Trayvon Martin's murder trial, we started Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, there was.
Anybody know their names? Okay. Yes. And there's one more that I didn't hear. I got Opal. Yes. Perfect. Thank you. So, we'll get you some buttons. Alicia Garza is an intersectional. Yes. Thank you. Is an intersectional organizer working out of the Bay Area. She originally posted the phrase. Patrice Cullors is an LA criminal justice organizer, and she made a hashtag of the phrase Black Lives Matter. And Opal Tumedi is a Nigerian-born, New York-based immigration organizer, and she set up the initial social media platform. Although the mission of the movement is intersectional, the group-centered model of leadership has led to a very cis male centering of protests. The movement knows far fewer Black women who have been killed by the police, and it largely turned its back on Corrine Gaines when she was murdered. And the main reason that people would say was because she put her son in danger, and she was also dismissed as crazy. This movement has also become male-centered because leaders such as Dee Ray and Sean King have been falsely credited with creating the organization.
All right, and we have just two more, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so this one, I am a human rights activist, poet, educator, Black Panther leader for 14 years. and a former political prisoner with the Black Panther Party. I also was the director of Oakland Community School. Who am I? Somebody said it.
It was over here.
I heard it first over there. I feel like it was you, wasn't it? You want two buttons, girl? You can get two buttons. Let me get you two buttons. Hold on just a minute. You can give one to your friend or something. Put one on one backpack, put one on like a on a leather jacket or something, I don't know. Rock out. All right, so Erica Hudgens is one of the most, I feel like, underappreciated people in the Black Panther Party, or at least when it comes to like being spoken about. She was a leader in the Black Panther Party for over 14 years and was the director of the Oakland Community School. The Oakland Community School was an amazing, amazing institution where students ranging in age from 2 to 11 years old received full tuition, health care, and lived in dorms where they received 3 nutritious meals a day. By May 12th of 1976, approximately 125 children attended the OCS school. 1 year later, the school was recognized by the California State Legislature for its inventive student-centered curriculum. She helped guide the Panthers in adopting parenting, collective parenting, providing for the material needs of children, boarding them during weekdays in dormitories, and the goals of these programs were to socialize Panther children to a collective lifestyle. Erica Hudgens insisted that Panthers, men and women, were to share in the responsibility of parenting Panther children, even if they did not have any biological offspring of their own. And she really kind of just created the mold for what a lot of Black and other like people of color, as far as like the homeschool co-ops that exist, just in general, like she was a major part of creating that framework and definitely of putting in work for so many years.
All right. I started the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League. I was a prolific Jamaican writer, organic intellectual, and pioneering Black publisher. You're so close. It's actually a trick question. It's his two wives, Amy Garvey. They have the same name. Amy Ashwood Garvey was Garvey's first wife. Yes, thank you. And they married in 1919, a year after they created the Negro World, which was a New York-based publication that highlighted a lot of the people active during the Harlem Renaissance. And she's quoted as saying, "A nation without great women is a nation frolicking in peril. Let us go forward and lift the degradations which rest on the Negro woman, God's most glorious gift to all civilizations." That's Amy Ashwood Garvey. And Amy Jock Garvey, his second wife, who he married in 1922, is quoted as saying, "Be not discouraged, Black women of the world, but push forward regardless of the lack of appreciation shown you." Neither of these women's writings are very easy to access. They've kind of been buried, although a lot of it was sort of the framework for the red, black, and green flag in Pan-Africanism, as well as Garveyism. And Marcus Garvey did not really approve of women having leadership positions. He created a lot of areas for women to be active, but not necessarily leaders, although a lot of his success and models came from the minds of these two women who were actually friends, best friends, and I don't think that they were later in life.
So give yourselves a round of applause. You guys actually did really, really, really good. That was awesome. So the reason why we wanted to kind of talk about those things first is to just kind of give you an idea as to how these types of aberrations of history happen. The same way a lot of the history of black people in this country in general has kind of been eroded. You know, we feel like, you know, Columbus sailed the ocean blue and then he just landed upon the, you know, on the nice seashores and Mary Pocahontas. You know, like we all know that that's not true, you know, but it took a lot of people calling it out and, you know, making sure that it was known that these things weren't true. And so, in essence, we kind of want to make sure that we're doing the same and so that it doesn't continue to happen. There are some reasons why women are erased from these struggles. I believe that it's out of three things. And it is that there's this idea that, actually, let me take that back. All black and African women leaders by default become feminists in deed, if not in thought. Once you resist tyranny from one source, you automatically resist it from another. It's like once you kind of enter the praxis of recognizing what oppression is and how to fight it, you become ultimately unwilling to deal with oppression from any source, whether it be sexist, whether it be ableist, whether it be homophobic, whether it be transphobic. All of those different things come into question, and rightfully so. So it just automatically happens. As a black woman, there's not a single black woman in history that I've researched and not seen something that she said as it relates to dealing with sexism and really feeling discredited or not really, you know, in the space that she should have been because of it. This innate opposition to male tyranny disturbs those who view this privilege as a birthright. So while it's almost a little bit more unspoken to hear somebody be just like a blatant, like, chauvinistic, you know, hyper-masculine, like, crazy person, it's definitely a thing that happens, and it usually happens in quiet. So when we're talking about organizing, as opposed to someone saying, oh, you're a woman, go wash dishes, when important meetings are had between other organizations or different things are being figured out or worked out, sometimes women are dismissed or not really invited to like the cool boys club, you know? I see lots and lots of sisters in this room, and so I wonder if you guys have had some of the same experiences. And consequently, chauvinistic, manipulative strategies to obscure the woman question as they depreciatingly refer to feminism as a white women's movement, erasing the origination of feminism in African egalitarian cultures. How many of you all have heard that feminism is, or heard someone say that feminism isn't for black women? Anybody? All the sisters in the room raised their hand. But yes, it's definitely something that's said more often than not. And one of the things that I really feel like was empowering to find out is that on the continent, indigenously, there were colonizers who came and they saw African women both working in the fields as well as tending to children, as well as, you know, carrying water, doing all the different things that needed to be done to help that community to survive. And they said, wow, you know, they're savages, their men don't care for them, you know, hand and foot, like they're actually doing stuff for themselves. And that kind of created this idea that African women were more manly or less than, you know, because they were actually equal at that point. It wasn't until colonization happened that African families and black families began to adopt Euro-patriarchal structures in the way that villages were run and in the way that families were run. When you look at other civilizations, you'll find oftentimes, even if there was male leadership, they were seeking guidance from either a council of elders or a council of women, or there was at least equal say-so in the things that happened for both parties. Now, this dangerous misconception, the feminist question, is an essential part of the Pan-African struggle, but it's the Achilles heel of Pan-Africanism. To liberate Africans from Eurocentric dominance, it is necessary to liberate them from the resultant patriarchy, scientific assumptions, legal inferences, and the Western moral code that has been so fervently incorporated into African society. Not that that's like not self-explanatory, but in order to deal with everything that has come from colonization, all bits and pieces of it have to be picked up, looked at, like, what is this, why is this here, and fully understanding what white supremacy is made of. It's not just racism. It has lots and lots of pieces to it. So in the movement, though ostensibly, I'm not even gonna use the big word, for the liberation of the black race was in word and deed for the liberation of the black male. How many of you have heard when they're trying to like silence you from talking about black women, they'll say, well, how come we just can't do it together? You know, like black women and black men should be doing this together. We would never do this without you. But then you see this. There was an entire movement during the civil rights era that was completely and holistically based in the pursuit of black masculinity. And it wasn't actual black masculinity, it was black masculinity as seen through the eyes of our colonizers. It was seen through the eyes of white America what black masculinity was and what it meant to be, which was basically in power and in control of your home, your resources, your finances. You were the person who got to make all the shots, call all the shots, and make all of the decisions. So race was extremely sexualized in the rhetoric of the movement, and freedom was equated with manhood, and the freedom of blacks with the redemption of black masculinity. So there was this kind of a term that went on that once black men were able to be afforded their masculinity, then boom, all problems stop, sexism is over, there's no issues, everything is good because I get to be a man. And ironically, that's something that still is a very much believed ideal today. This assumption illustrates both an acceptance of masculinity defined within the context of patriarchy, as well as a disregard for the human need for the integrity and liberty felt by both men and women and all people. Next, I'm going to read some quotes from some pretty well-known leaders in the Black liberation movement. Amiri Baraka said, and so this separation of black men and women is the cause of need for self-consciousness and eventual healing. But we must erase the separateness by providing ourselves with a healthy African identity, or what he perceived to be that. By embracing a value system that knows of no separation, but only of the divine complement the black woman is for her man. For instance, we do not believe in the equality of men and women. We cannot understand what the devils and the devilishly influenced mean when they say equality for women. We can never be equals. Nature has not provided this. So he says that not only men and women are different, but that there is no reciprocity in their relationship to each other. That men don't owe women anything, but that women are there for men. The two do not submit to one another, but rather the woman submits to her black man. Next. Eldridge Cleaver, how many of you all are familiar with Eldridge Cleaver? Pretty much everybody, for the most part, knows who Eldridge Cleaver was. How many of you all have read Soul on Ice? Oh, man, that's tough. So in Soul on Ice, which was a book that was actually on the Black Panther reading list for a while, and he spoke about some of the things that he did. And although he later, apologized for them, a lot of the ways in which he moved within the party kind of proved that he hadn't quite learned the lesson. He said, I became a rapist. To refine my technique and modus operandi, I started out by practicing on black girls in the ghetto. In the black ghetto, where vicious and dark deeds appear not as aberrations or deviations from the norm, but as part of the sufficiency of evil of the day. And when I considered myself smooth enough, I crossed the tracks and sought out white prey. Like, is that not crazy to like hear from somebody who was leading and was so much a part of some of the most major movements that black liberation has seen to this day? Do any of you all have any type of comments or questions or ideas about that? Yeah.
This is a totally great question because to me, it's your name is black men in this space, and why not put the devil's who was definitely there? So I don't see a balance, I'm just feeling.
Right. I totally understand. So the reason why it's important that we're talking about some of the things that don't often get talked about is that it paints a picture that's not accurate. You know, we do often, if you go Google, in fact, I have a task for you. Google Black Liberation Movement. Every single picture that you see, with the exception of maybe one or two, will be of Black men who were in the Black Liberation Movement. So there's not really an absence of space and agency for that. However, there is a lack of space and agency for dealing with some of the issues that have arisen from those, some of the issues that happen.
And also to the point about Frederick Douglass, we have to remember that we do have to be critical of our leaders. A thing about Frederick Douglass that I learned actually this year was that he had a Black wife, but he moved a white woman into their home and kept her as an in-house mistress to the total disrespect of his Black wife. So that's something that we have to acknowledge when we say he's a feminist, because that doesn't sound very feminist to me.
I understand. I mean, we're a co-ed organization, so we definitely have men and women and non-binary people within our organization, and purposefully so. I think that it's a much bigger detriment to ignore the things that happen and they just kind of fester and build up underneath the rug and they never get dealt with. And then we have today. And we have the Black Liberation Movement as it stands. And we have people like Umar Johnson and Sahra Susan Steady who are kind of, you know, speaking for the masses of Black people as it relates to the movement. It's kind of been hijacked by that. And so I think that it's irresponsible to kind of wash everything with like this picture of, you know, everything was great and Black power was nice and everything was, you know. Yeah, I mean, I think that the balance is the truth, you know, and the balance, they say the truth will set you free, right? So these thoughts and writings and others that were accepted, even promoted misogyny and misogynoir, translated into the day-to-day experiences between women and men in the Black Panther Party and other movements, visible in the rules, the structures, and the accepted habits within the historical and even current Black power organizations. So Elaine Brown recalls a meeting in Black Congress in which she and other women were forced to wait to eat until the men were served for food, for which they had all contributed money. So the reason why we're talking about these things is that they did translate into the way that work was being done. It translated into the way that women were being treated within those organizations who are equally responsible for the success of the organizations. She said, sisters, the rules were then explained to her that sisters did not challenge brothers. They stood behind their Black men, supported their men, and respected them in essence. It was not only unsisterly of us to not want to eat with our brothers, it was a sacrilege for which blood could be shed.
Also in Taste of Power, Elaine Brown wrote about an incident with within the party where a woman named Regina Davis was beaten by the brothers of the party. Elaine went to Huey P. Newton and told him about how upset she was that this woman had been beaten, her jaw was broken. And Huey challenged her to a debate. Elaine states that she didn't engage in the debate with Huey. She chose to, she says that she chose to flee from the fight. Which she later says was a bad decision because the issue of sexism still persisted. Like she says here, did we overcome it? Of course we didn't. Or as I like to say, we didn't get these brothers from revolutionary heaven.
So it must also be stressed that not only many of the men, but also a great number of women in Black liberations who are enforcing strict gender role, who enforce strict gender roles on Black women. In much of the same way that women in predominant society do not resist but encourage sexism, Black women fell prey to perpetuating patriarchy within the Black community. So some of the things that Kenneth.
But okay,
all
right,
she's right. but some of the things that can occur when we're dealing with sexism, and it's the normal average you know, situation of the day is that even myself, and the reason why I guess it's so important to me to explain these things is that I kind of came from getting involved in a more militant movement and kind of being shown the ropes, you know, in a way that I was like, okay, so is this what it looks like? So is this how it works, you know? And I wanted to see that happen. I was like all about Black Power. I was like, okay, if this is what that is, then I want to do that, you know? And you start to see the way that those types of decisions can affect the way that the party is even able to continue and to continue to run. So there are some myths that divert Black women from deciding to pursue their own liberation. Some of it is social. You know, we don't feel like it's okay to talk about these things. We feel like they should be kept in house. You know, you don't want to put your dirty laundry out there. But then there's also the fact that it's believed that the Black woman is already liberated, and already oppressed Black men cannot oppress Black women, or the idea that oppressed people cannot oppress other people. In any movement of color, whether we're talking about indigenous people, Latinx people, whether we're talking about Black people, these are the very same structures that have been repeated over and over and over again in liberation movements. So it's not something that simply deals with Black people, but that's what we're talking about today. So I really want to shoot it home that these are issues that exist in pretty much every movement. I just got through having a workshop about anti-Blackness and sexism and anarchist movements. It's a thing, you know? And if we never ever talk about those things, then they never ever come to light. Thank you. There's an idea that racism is the primary or only oppression Black women have to confront. That feminism is nothing but man-hating and is a white woman's issue, or that feminism just serves to dog Black men. Women's issues are narrow and apolitical. Women of color need to deal with the larger struggle. So you have to kind of separate yourself from yourself in order to be a good member of the Black Power movement, if it's of an unintersectional Black Power movement. I don't know about you, but when I wake up every morning, I am both Black and woman at the same time. I never ever like have an out-of-body experience, you know? I've woken up as a woman since I was born, and these are things that you can't separate. So to say that there's a movement that's bigger than the movement that exists in my body is a lie, for one, but it's also something that they want to perpetuate and kind of force you into. You know, you feel like you can't talk about it because you wonder, okay, well, does it sound bad? You know, no, it looks bad, it feels bad, it is all of those things, and until it's talked about, it never happens, it never changes. And then finally, those feminists are nothing but lesbians. Ah! We having fun though! She's gonna talk to you a little bit more about misogynoir and explain to you what it is.
So misogynoir is sort of a new word. For, I don't know, hopefully nobody in here. It was coined by a queer Black woman named Moya Bailey. And it is essentially misogyny, but misogyny that is specific to Black women, in that we have to combat racism and sexism at the same time, sexualized racism and racialized sexism. And so what we talk about is working to end both of those things at the same time, because our identity can't be split down the middle on gender and race.
So to seal it up, racism and sexism must be confronted at the same time. To wait for one to end before working on the other reflects an incomplete understanding of the way racism and sexism as forms of oppression work to perpetuate each other. When one form of oppression is unsuccessful in stopping the empowerment of an oppressed people, for instance, police brutality, if they found out that everybody in this room was gonna be rioting for police brutality, and they were like, we're never gonna have it, you don't even get to come on our block, we are strong as hell all together. However, if you can sprinkle some privileges on it for a couple of people who are in that group, Let's say it's just the people with red hair. And the people with red hair don't have to deal with some of the things that people with other colored hair have to deal with. Who do you think becomes the overlords over that group immediately? The people who have that privilege, the people who have been given that piece of the American pie, if you will. And so it's like if one of those things doesn't work, internally what has always kind of destroyed movements from the inside are the internal issues that don't get dealt with. It's the abuse, it's the sexual assault, it's the misogynistic statements, the sexist statements, it's all of those different things that don't really get dealt with because they're kind of seen as secondary issues. But if the personal isn't political and the political isn't personal, then we'll never ever get to the point of liberation because they don't exist outside of each other. You don't become liberated and have personal issues that continue on and on and on and actually consider yourself liberated. You know, I could be free of racism. I could be free of having to deal with racism, or maybe that's not even something that I've ever experienced, but if I'm being abused at home, what is my quality of life like? Am I really a liberated person? Probably not, you know? And so one can be anti-racist and pro-misogyny. Being one does not predicate an understanding of the other. I could want racism to end for sure, but not really care about who it is that is being marginalized in the process. And so we see that even within this movement, there's a hindrance to kind of get involved in other aspects or to see agency of other people that don't necessarily look like us or have the same experiences. Just like really quickly, something that was totally separate, or I guess it should be, or maybe it shouldn't be, was a trip that I took to North Dakota for Standing Rock. And I thought, okay, it's gonna be great, everything's gonna be awesome, and I posted it online. And was told, you know, well, where are they at the Black Lives Matter protest? Like, when have they been there? You know, and to place the question of someone else's oppression on whether or not they've participated in solving yours doesn't acknowledge the way in which another person may be oppressed to an even higher extent. So, you know, to use that ruler is often the way in which within our movement how sexism has been able to prevail, because you feel like, okay, well, I'm fighting for Black power, it's not possible for me to harm someone else in the process of that. I'm obviously, you know, oppressed, but it can obviously work both ways. Did you have anything to?
No, we have 20 minutes.
Oh, okay, we have 20 minutes. All right, so we're gonna skip on. So Frances Beall said that since the advent of Black power, the Black male has exerted more prominent leadership role in our struggle and justice in this country, but that he's seen the system for, and that he sees the system for what it really is for the most part, but where he rejects its values and more on many issues is when it comes to women, and he seems to take his guidelines from the pages of the Ladies Home Journal. So we're gonna then talk about how this happened. You know, I definitely felt what the sister was saying, and it can kind of feel, it makes your back hot a little bit. You know, when you're talking about things that are really personal and you feel like, you know, someone is kind of being like ragged on. But it's really important to recognize where things came from so that we can solve them. If you'll move on. So how many of y'all are familiar with this guy? Doesn't he look like a descendant of Donald Trump? Like, he looks like they have to be in the same family, just the way his mouth is shaped, like it has to be. So this is Moynihan, and he wrote the, Daniel Moynihan, and he wrote the Negro Family, The Case for National Action, known as the Moynihan Report. This was supported by some Black leaders initially, and coined thought by Black sociologist Frank E. Frazier, who charged that in Moynihan's words, in essence, the Negro community has been forced into a matriarchal structure, which, because it is so out of line with the rest of American society, seriously retards the progress, or submission and assimilation, I should say, of the group as a whole, and imposes a crushing burden on the Negro male. Ours is a society which presumes male leadership in private and public affairs. The arrangement of society, or white supremacy, facilitates such leadership and rewards it. A subculture such as that of the American Negro, in which this is not a pattern, is placed at a distinct disadvantage or a difficulty to control. So in that short paragraph, he was really pretty blatant and honest about what it was that they were attempting to do, and pretty much spelled out the fact that he knew that Black and African families were not naturally that way, but that because they weren't, they were more difficult to control. And so he was an aspect of the war on poverty and was used by both Lyndon B. Johnson and Kennedy in the process of destroying Black families purposefully. You know, they looked at them and they tried to find out, okay, well, how can we say that, you know, these things are happening? And so they stipulated that issues plagued Black communities were due to overpowering Black women and single parent homes. I wrote in the facts of racism and discrimination on both Black men and women. He was a tool in the LBJ war on poverty, much like the war on drugs was just really a war on Black poor people. And hope that having Black men rule over women like second class versions of traditional 40s and 50s white culture, giving a few middle class jobs and positions to Black men, Black people would become again a subject people to white supremacist America. Now, while the report was even more widely discredited as racist and a sneaky attempt at blaming victims of oppression for their own oppression, many propositions about the Black family structures and its issues were parroted in the following Black liberation movement, where, quiet as it's kept, they originated with Frazier and others. The notion of Black emasculation at the hands of a super powerful Black woman clearly shaped the context for the emergence of Black power. As a result, Black power movement has been inextricably linked to the belief in Black male dominance and the restoration of manhood that was separate from and even antagonistic to Black womanhood in the scholarly literature and popular imagination. So what I'm explaining there is that the Black power movement, while it was not specifically, you know, okay, this is what's happening, but this was some of the rhetoric that was parroted and was spoken about over and over and over again. It was that single Black mothers were incapable of raising sons, and that's why X, Y, and Z is happening. It was that Black women weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing, but no one really questioned, you know, what happened to the Black men. No one questioned what white supremacy had done in the mass incarceration of Black men, what they had done with the poverty of Black families, and how people were kind of forced into those situations. It kind of just sought to create a scapegoat for it, and some people took that hook, line, and sinker. Oh, I'm tired of talking now.
Just gonna continue on.
Conversely, from this image. within feminist movements, Gloria Steinem was also sort of a, to the misogynoir point, feminists could be racist towards Black women. She created the term strong Black woman. That was actually not created by a Black woman. And it's also a term that has been sort of detrimental to Black women. It leads to a thought that Black women can deal with anything, which leads to people not pursuing mental health. It also leads to people overburdening Black women and feeling like no remorse for doing so. And it also makes Black women, when they are overburdened in that way, sort of respond with, or I should say not respond with a no, to sort of take it all on because we've been told that we're strong, we can deal with anything.
So the historiography of the Black freedom movement has most often depicted women as either victims of or combatants against patriarchal Black nationalism. While in some ways the Black Panther Party did become a place where Black men and women could be radicalized around issues of gender and tools to challenge sexism and patriarchy and reconceptualize gender roles, it also had aspects of it where the Black power principle of equality were kind of left undefined. If Black women assumed a role of leadership, she was said to be eroding Black manhood, to be hindering the progress of the Black race, and that she was an enemy of Black people. Now, although women in the Black Panther Party were challenging these notions by responding, by waging formidable liberation struggle inside the liberation struggle in an attempt to put the movement on a more egalitarian course, there were definitely intra-racial and external oppressions that should not be forgotten or overshadowed. But there's good news. The very real lessons about Black women's history embedded in these women's survival strategies and their tenacity and skill in fashioning their womanhood out of the materials they found, even in the most challenging of environments. It is central to their story as the barriers they faced, the challenges they endured, and the sexism which constrained them. Next. Everyone's familiar, that was actually for the other thing. Go on. How many of you all are familiar with COINTELPRO? Gosh, everybody should be, right? COINTELPRO did something that kind of placed women in a position of being in leadership positions because COINTELPRO sought to take out the people who were in leadership positions, as well as some women, as far as like putting them in prison, killing them, creating snitch jackets, all the whole nine, everything that COINTELPRO did to seek to create discord and to destroy the Black Panther Party. But in the context of repression and internal destabilization, women provided the organizational foundation that allowed the Panthers to withstand some of those ravages. As militancy and the idea of armed protection came on the scene, again in the Black Liberation Movement of the 70s, women in the Panthers did that of their foremothers like Harriet Tubman, Mary Stagecoach Fields, and Ida B. Wells, and became advocates of self-defense as a personal and collective strategy. It's important to note that women's pivotal roles in international guerrilla movements did not always translate into empowerment outside of the field of battle or after the revolution. There's someone who wrote a lot about it. His name was Robert Sankara, and he was the president of a place called Burkina Faso. He was one of the first African presidents to endorse women's rights and to create actual functioning organizations that ensured those things. Because he saw that even after liberation, even after him taking that seat, that sexism was still something that was happening in the country, that women were still being abused, and that they weren't really able to move around the way that they needed to be. Battles for national liberation too often re-inscribe patriarchy by analyzing gender contradictions as a secondary consideration. And these images thus represent the Panthers' replication of the potentials and limitations of the trope of the female guerrilla fighter. These and other contradictions of sexism became more and more apparent. But the combination of pressure to maintain, at least outwardly, racial solidarity with Black men and of the alienation of the agenda of the predominantly white middle-class women's movement, historically, for Black women's reluctance to identify as feminist. So we've talked about that several times. It was just kind of like a weird place to be in, and it kind of still is. Because for an organization like Black Women's Defense League, even to this day, to say that I'm against domestic violence, that I'm against rape, that I'm against homophobia, transphobia, that we are for, you know, the rights of women, that we're for the protection of women, regardless of who it is from, and to do those things, it still kind of places you in like this weird middle ground, because like the liberal feminist groups are like, nah, and the Black Power groups are kind of like, you know, you're a lesbian feminist, and so there's no space, you know, and. But it's just really important, and the only reason why it gets done is because there's no other choices. So we still find ourselves in the same predicament today. Lastly, we're gonna talk about reproductive justice. So there was freedom in sexuality, parenting, and family structure which were struggled towards. Black women in the Black Panther Party made great strides while the party's rejection and principles of the commodification of intimate relationships under capitalism, basically the idea that you could own someone, was something that they were really against. They weren't really as much indebted to making sure that it was equal for both men and women, because when women were engaged in these situations, sometimes there was a child that resulted if, you know, pregnancy or if protection wasn't used. And it used to be a party line that you know, using birth control was a form of abortion and that you just basically shouldn't do it. And so they started to pursue things dealing with reproductive justice, and Ashley is gonna talk more about that.
I'm actually a birth worker. I was trained as a doula by Nicole Deggins in New Orleans, Louisiana, Sister Midwife Productions, which trains people in the granny midwife tradition. Because Black American women have some of the lowest positive birth outcomes, the maternal mortality rate is, I didn't look it up, so I don't know, but it's like, it's on par with a developing or third world nation, as well as the infant mortality rate, which is widely disproportionate to the outcomes for white women in this country.
So I'm gonna leave you guys with some takeaways. And it was a lot to kind of squeeze into a very, very short period of time. But these are just some of the things that I felt like were important. So sexism reinforces power imbalances within the organizational hierarchy and confounds the progress of organizations. Weaponized Black manhood has been made as a pawn and used to maintain white supremacy. I really want to make sure that it's known that manhood in and of itself is not bad. Manhood in and of itself is not a bad thing. That's not what we're trying to say here. But that manhood as dictated and described by Euro-patriarchy is a bad thing. You know, toxic masculinity is a bad thing. It can be used as a pawn to maintain white supremacy through internal confrontations and contradictions. If, you know, you're constantly dealing with the issues that arise between toxic masculinity and abuse and all of those different things, think of how much movements are really stifled and not allowed to progress because of dealing with those issues, or just the idea that Black male leadership or male leadership in and of itself is the, you know, the quintessential way, but then just sometimes maybe women could be involved. Like, that idea limits the minds of so many people, and it limits the ability for women and even children and everybody to be able to have their equal share of power, their equal share of say-so, and their equal share of, like, the creative means of an organization to succeed and prosper. Patriarchy and paternalism continues to affect political movements. We talked about it with Black Lives Matter. I was a fully, fully indebted member of Huey P. Newton Gun Club prior to the situation that I faced. I would have liked to continue to have been a member of that organization. I think that I was a pretty good member of that organization. But it forms a blind spot that fails to address sexism and the sexualization of Black women and girls in prevalent society. Instead, it often chooses to speak against them through blaming Black women and through sex shaming. Homophobia and transphobia continue, especially in more so-called militant Pan-Africanist circles, and divorces those who have been some of the most valiant freedom fighters in the civil rights movement, like Bayard Rustin, Langston Hughes, James Baldwin, the Stonewall Riots with Marsha P. Johnson and Major Griffin Gracie, and other Black liberation struggles where their involvement was diminished or erased. Our brothers and sisters were ousted as quote-unquote un-African. But even this has evolved from a European-gleaned concept of what Africanness is, and leads to a violent intolerance and invisibility of violence towards queer Black people, both intra-racially and by the state. How many of you all remember the Pulse nightclub shooting? Everybody? So as I remember, the night that it happened was Puerto Rican Pride Night, right? So that meant that there were Black bodies in there. And that meant that those Black bodies were erased and ignored by the quote-unquote Black power movement. And sometimes it was even talked about badly. It was just like, you know, they deserved it. There were really horrible things that were being said. But more often than not, it was just pretty much ignored. And so what patriarchy is able to do is it creates a blind spot. It kind of creates this group of people who aren't worthy of protection. And it ensures that they remain that way, because if you question it, it's like, are you gay? It, you know, like I've literally seen comrades of mine, male comrades of mine, stand up for, you know, some of our trans comrades, and they get questioned. You know, it's really kind of like a bully relationship that happens with patriarchy, because even if you don't want to be a part of it, it's kind of like you get your masculinity becomes questioned when you decide that you don't want to be. Misogyny and unchecked male leadership in Black liberation clears the way for clearly problematic people like Umar Johnson, Sahra Sutton Seti, Tariq Nasheed. I don't know if any of you all know about who those people are. But they're allowed to kind of gain legitimacy in a movement whose praxis is based in negation and the protection of toxic masculinity and not necessarily the protection of all Black people. Valuable people, both men and women, are lost as comrades in the Black liberation struggle when they are disenfranchised by violent, misogynistic rhetoric, or worse, abused without recourse in Black liberation circles. The emergence of terms like HOTEP in describing this misogynoir and toxic masculinity as a derivative of African culture is damaging and serves to cheapen the wealth of knowledge and ancestral experiences of those before us. The rebuttals to those questioning misogyny and patriarchy and Black liberation are rooted in the same rhetoric of white supremacy to the questions of racism and structural inequality. This is proof of Black patriarchy's paternalistic nature. So when, for instance, and I really hate to call out the sister, but it's kind of like when you, have you ever been in a room, and I can say this for people of color, you ever been in a room and you're talking about some of the things that are happening? Maybe it's a conservative group of people, you know, that you're around, and you're talking about police brutality, and they're just like, but what about like the good police officer who didn't do anything, like he lives down my street? You know, you immediately feel dismissed. And so a lot of the same tools that are used by white supremacist cultures that really kind of either dismiss or erase the experiences of Black people and people of color are the same types of dismissals that Black women and women of color face when speaking about the oppressions that are happening to them. Almost to the freaking T. Like, I really wish that like there could be like a conversation so people could see it, but it definitely happens, and it really proves just how paternal the nature of how Black patriarchy happened. So to end, Black liberation must evolve and learn to be critical of itself in order to continue to grow as a formidable movement and not only destroy white supremacy, but construct Black freedom not rooted in other forms of supremacy. That's all we want. That's all.
Thank you for sticking around to the very, very end. Thank you to the Black Women's Defense League for allowing us to record this podcast. We have talked to them at the conference, and we hope to have them on the show to do a regular interview soon. And we look forward to that. And look out, because on It's Going Down, we will be releasing every couple days some of these podcasts, recordings from the conference. And once again, if you're going to a conference, you're going to a book fair, you're going to some sort of talk, if you want to just even stick a smartphone in front of somebody and hit the record button, make sure that you get the okay first, of course. But if you want to record stuff wherever you're at, send it to us. We'll put it on the show. We'll put it on the air. We'll send it around. We love doing that stuff. Thanks to everybody that's listening, everybody that's donated. We are about maybe $40 away from hitting our fundraising goal, and we're only about, well, we're about two-thirds of the month. So thank you once again for helping us. Thank you for getting to our goal. We got a lot more in store for you. And please check out It's Going Down. Subscribe to our iTunes page. Every couple days, we will release a couple more of these workshops from the Roar Conference. We've got about four recordings. And we also have regular shows coming up for you every week. Don't forget, we're still here. We're still cranking them out. And big ups to all the people involved in the Roar Conference. They really, really work their ass off, and it shows. Probably one of the best North American anarchist events, anarchist organized at least, events I've been to, if not ever, in a very long time. Really great time. really great group of people, really amazing energy. This should be the standard across North America and across the world for the kind of work that we not only put in, but we expect and that we produce. Great job, y'all. We'll talk to you soon.